Hi, Miriam. Thanks so much for joining me today. If you could give our audience a bit of a background, and we can get into it then.
Yeah, thank you for having me today. I guess just before we get started, I just want to sort of lay it out there, just a disclaimer that those are going to be my views and not necessarily Pender Ventures' views. And this is not advice for investment either. So I guess a little bit of background about myself. I actually was born and raised in Morocco, spent a better half of my life there, and then moved to Quebec to for school. So I came in early 2010s for my MBA and then stayed thereafter, moved to Montreal for career options and then stayed here in Canada since then. So definitely kind of my second home. I studied business administration and finance, and then as I graduated, went to do some consulting in biomaterials, spent some time across a couple of R&D firms, and then landed in an R&D company that was working on sort of technical textile and wearables. That was sort of the big trend, integrating sensors into either watches or clothing or other form of wearables that we wear. And that's how I really got exposed to sort of the Montreal, or generally speaking, the Canadian venture capital and entrepreneurship world. I caught the bug there. So I jumped and tried to build a company in the wearable space, but really with an angle towards remote patient monitoring. It wasn't cold then RPM at that point. It was sort of free CPT codes. There was really no structure around it. So what we were doing, it was a platform. We had a few sensors. The idea was to really use radio frequency to capture vital signs at a distance without having contact with the skin. And so applications were obviously autonomous or semi-autonomous elderly people at home, maybe patients. And so everyone who's kind of bothered by having to charge their devices. So we had a few applications. It was definitely more of a deep tech space because we really had to build sort of the sensor from scratch. And at that time, not a lot of I would say not a lot of VC investors, generally speaking, but also so few deep tech investors in particular. So we did that for a few years. We built, an MVP. We had a few partnerships and ongoing projects with tier one OEMs. We kind of tried the healthcare route where we wanted to do more RPM, but there was really no revenue model. And so I think my biggest learning there was entrepreneurship. There's a, you know, there's the product, there's a problem, there's a product market fit, but there's timing as well. And sometimes if you're too early, too late, I think that is a big factor. So the ability to kind of hang around and wait for the right time where the revenue model is enabled and the market is ready and the consumer is ready is definitely something that sometimes could be overlooked. And then vice versa, if you're too late into a market, then you may capture a little bit of the market, but not necessarily win the market. So,
And do you have a technical background,
yeah.
Miriam? Do you have a technical background?
No, I don't have a technical background by education. I'm a self-taught programmer. I was always very tech curious. I actually did math, and then I was going, obviously, next natural logical step was computer science, and I changed my mind and I was like, no, I want to do business. And so that's how I kind of switched very, very last minute. But I still always stayed super tech curious. I taught myself how to design, taught myself how to program. I mean, now it's probably irrelevant because you can do a lot of that with AI, so that's cool. But I don't have a particularly technical background. For my company, I did have a technical co-founder, obviously. But I would say that I do understand tech quite well.
So how did you come up
And
with this idea, or did you come up with the idea with your co-founder, and how did you What was your role in the startup, and what was your co-founder's role?
Yeah, so when I was at the R&D lab, I looked at a lot of companies that we were kind of working with and supporting. We were sort of service providers for them. And there, most of the companies were using optical sensors. So as I was sort of working with these founders, entrepreneurs, and CEOs, a lot of the issues were just data accuracy. Like the Fitbit was essentially a random number generated at the beginning. Like it was really, there was no data that you could trust. And then with AI and with the more data you got, then they started kind of denoising the signal, and they started getting more better and better. And so when I was looking at it at that time, a lot of it was, oh, optical sensors is not not accurate, very prone to noise, very prone to sort of skin color and skin tone and tattoos and the light conditions outside. So I think you could think about it in two ways. There's the software, AI, ML, at that point probably ML route that you can actually get. The more data you get, you can prove on the accuracy, or you can look at it from the more difficult point of view, which is, oh, hardware, how can we actually work with better sensors, and what would that be? So I was back and forth looking at these, I think, internally and with myself, and came across this, I think it was an event, came across my co-founder, who was more of a PhD in RF signals, and was also kind of exploring the same space, but I would say from the technical side of it. And that's how we came together. We incubated the company in a sort of an accelerator incubator in Montreal, and the roles were tech and sort of business. But early days, when you're building something in deep tech, I think as a co-founder, your role is really to A, make sure that we are getting that you are that product market fit. Where does this, what are we solving here? Who are we solving it for? What are different paths to market? Which one to prioritize? What are the low hanging fruits? Because for this kind of solutions, you can go really different routes. Consumer health, you can even do regular, like we had a lot of interest, for example, from aviation. They were like, oh, we would love to know when people feel thirsty, or when people feel hungry, or if you can collect some of that data. We had, for example, automotive, like if you can do it in the steering wheel, and you can kind of get that data, sort of health data, without having to wear anything in the car. So there were so many applications, and it's really hard not to chase all of them at the same time, because everyone's like, yeah, super interesting, would love to work with you guys. So there's definitely keeping that discipline of like what is actual opportunity and what is sort of non-recurring engineering work that you want to do to generate cash flow to fund sort of the bigger, grander vision. So yeah, and then building the team is definitely obviously another very, very sticky critical point for any entrepreneur out there. I made so many mistakes. I think to me, the hardest, if anyone sort of asked what was the hardest thing to navigate, I think it's like team building, finding the right people, having the right people in the right seats, is definitely the hardest. And people can make or break a company, obviously. So that was a lot of learning, as a first time founder. So that was a little bit of the background on the company. And then after I actually was looking to buy a business. I was like, oh, maybe startups and tech startups are hyped up, and
And where were
capital
you
intensive.
from a personal finance perspective? Like, were you looking to get a loan from the bank, or did you have capital saved, or did you have an exit from your startup? How were you looking to fund these acquisitions at that point?
Yeah, well, it was def I had a partner who I would say definitely was more advanced in his career, both age and career. And then we were going to leverage that to actually get a debt and finance it by debt. So that would have been sort of my portion of it. So we came together and we started looking for businesses. And there is, as you know, we talk a lot about the next generation. There's a lot of businesses that will go bankrupt or have to disappear because there's nobody else to continue and take over their leadership. So we spent a lot of time actually talking to all of these entrepreneurs, and we're not, this is not startups, this is really businesses of all kinds. We came down to sort of this pallet business to actually for transportation for pharmaceuticals, and it was interesting. But I think two learnings there. The first thing is there's a whole generation of businesses that need sort of folks to take over their leadership, but at the same time, a lot of them are bound to disappear. They're just not sort of current with the times. So there were a lot of businesses that you can just not see kind of continuing with everything that with the tech and all the advancements in the last few years. And then the second one is that if you're gonna buy a small business, it coming from like tech and due diligence and like being really down into the details and all that, it was really hard to wrap your head around about like this one person business, had all accounts all over the place, and you're not sure where the contracts are, and so you had to take a leap of faith if you really wanted to do that. Most of these companies are not necessarily well organized, I would say, and well run. So it wasn't, it was maybe a 6 month process. I really looked at a few companies, did some diligence on one, and then didn't get there at the end of the I actually backed out, but the person that I was working with on sort of looking through these, I do know that he ended up buying that business. And it was about the same time, but I backed out because I just didn't have the conviction that sort of that would have scaled nicely, and I wasn't sure what kind of tech we can add to it, because my vision, my personal one, was buy a business, add tech to it, supercharge it, not necessarily buy it and run it as is and maybe generate a couple millions a year and with your, I don't know, 30% gross margin and pay a couple employees. Like that was not sort of what I was looking for. Anyways, I was talking about all this in a conference, came across an old friend of mine, and they mentioned they had a healthcare fund, 25 million. They were looking for folks to kind of help them out with setting up the fund, and so that's how I joined. I had a little bit of the I had the entrepreneurship background at least for a few years. I understood healthcare, so I was like, oh, this is interesting. I went into it thinking that would be the perfect way to get exposed to so many other companies and then maybe get back to building to joining one of them. But then I don't know. Did I get comfortable, or I'm not sure. It just never translated into the next step in my operating, experience. And I stayed there for a couple of years and moved to BDC Capital, which is a Crown Corp here in Canada, and in one of their direct funds. And then more recently at Pender Ventures, where we invest in B2B software and healthcare IT in North America. Right now, investing out of our second fund, $100 million fund, mostly do sort of companies that are over that 1 million, 1.5 million in revenue. So that's a bit of background.
Talk to me about your diligence process when looking at businesses to buy, more from a, sounds like almost a PE perspective, when you were looking with your partner. And how does that diligence process differ from your current diligence process looking at healthcare startups?
Very different, I would say. Startups are sort of set up, most of the time they've already had investors before They have, it's not a one person shop. They have a legal counsel. They're much more organized, I would say, just from tracking revenue. Like they have teams to do a lot of things. Buying a small business, like if it is quite a different journey. You have to, I think you have to have the understanding of what you're looking for. You probably have to do a lot of heavy lifting actually putting together that data room, the equivalent of a data room in the startup world. I do remember spending a ton of time at the company's offices actually putting together that information, because they just, it was scattered. I don't think the plan was to sell the business necessarily. And so there was really no structure to it. You just had to and get comfortable around that. Whereas tech companies or sort of more established businesses, and obviously, you know, I'm comparing with, again, a one-man shop. It was a very small business. It was doing like $1 million a year. It was paying him good. You know, it was a good business for him and his very small team. But I am pretty sure that other, you know, other businesses are much more sort of mature in the way they're run. In terms of tech startups, it's quite, it's almost like I can't really compare both of them, right? Startups are usually sort of, especially today, there's a ton of accelerators, there's a ton of incubators, there's a lot of mentors, a lot of programs like CDLs and others, Next AI, to really help you out with the first thing to do. A lot of support from government via different organizations. So you just have much more maturity in how to set up the business at the beginning. You can get a lot of advice from all kind of peers. So it makes it really easier for us to kind of come in, and companies are usually running a process. They have structured data rooms. The startups, I would say, you have to, and it's also quite different in terms of the outcome you're expecting from that transaction, right? If I compare it with the small business, the expectation was to, again, rent a small business, pay yourself a salary that's comfortable, and then potentially grow it, compound in very small, you know, probably, I don't know what the number would be, but sub 20% growth year over year, and get it better and optimize it. Startups, you really have to believe this is going to be sort of a you know, big return for the fund. You have to believe that the market opportunity is huge, that this team can execute, and that this product can really sort of win or be one of the winners in the market. So all of these elements are quite different because you're not expecting the same outcome. You're not expecting that 10x, or you don't want to see that. You're not looking for that when you're looking at small businesses versus a startup, where you're like, well, I do have investors, and that I, you know, as a venture fund, your job really is to raise money, invest in companies, return the money, and that's really the cycle of it, and you have to think about it from that perspective.
Would you invest in a bad founder, and I get bad is very subjective here, with an amazing product building in a growing or in the right market? Or if
This
you had a
is
choice,
very
it's
interesting
that,
question.
yeah, it's either that
You
or an
know,
amazing founder in a market you think is destined to fail, and their current product is you know, quote unquote, garbage.
this is an interesting question. I think, to me personally, I think team is actually number one thing. And I learned that as an operator, but also as an investor in across the, you know, last 7 or 8 years. I actually did have that conviction many times before, where you're like looking at amazing, you know, super strong product. Like the opportunity is sort of really big, and you're like super excited about that. And then you look at the team, and you're like, I'm not sure this is the right team that will bring that will execute on this opportunity very well. And so many times you're like, I'll do the deal. I'm pretty sure we can coach them and work with the CEO and help them out, and And so you kind of you lead yourself to believe that you can really change the leadership, or you can change and help coaching them and supporting them in their journey to learn. What happens, and pretty much from my super humble experience, is that it never works out. Like, it does just never work out. You can't really, you're not running as an investor, you're not running the business, you're not really operating it. So you can coach and help and support, but really the team is the one that's going to make it happen. So it's to me, it's actually very obvious today from some mistakes that I've made in the past. The team is actually number one. And maybe sometimes I may be wrong, and you can sort of argue that there is a case where it worked, but I definitely think that you have to, if there is a great CEO, strong team, strong founders, strong management team, not super great market, they'll find a way. They'll find a way, they'll pivot, they'll navigate through all of that to find an opportunity and execute on it and win. Versus you can have a super strong product if you don't have the right people in the right seats. I think it's bound to it would eventually fail. So
The last past 5 weeks, a lot has changed. And I'm talking about our quote unquote cousins south of the border, specifically in terms of tariffs. And you know, the cost of doing business with the states will go up as a result. It sounds like across the board, even for digital services. How do you predict these tariffs will impact Canadian venture and healthcare startups? Do you see do you predict a rise in as a result, maybe kind of born out of patriotism or a little bit of a pride of your own country? Or do you see, you know, most or a change in where funds and startups are domiciled and have moved down south as the market kind of remains in the US, especially the M&A market and even the IPO market to an extent.
Yeah, I think there are a few parts to this question. It's definitely current one that we're following every day, because we I would say we're definitely kept on our toes, and companies are also kind of really closely monitoring this. I think maybe to unpack it, definitely on the economic side, if you're right now, at least if you're selling a device or a physical product, if as an entrepreneur, if the entrepreneurs or the teams are not haven't already done the math on how that would impact their economics, then they should. That's probably something that if it's delayed, not delayed, ended up being completely wiped out, doesn't matter. Like, you just have to really understand how that will affect your economics and your budgets and sort of so on that's the immediate, I would say, impact. The other one, which is sort of adjacent, is maybe the buy US, buy American sort of sentiment that I think companies may not necessarily be factoring into their thinking. If no one asks, you don't have to say you're American, like, or Canadian or whatever. So, but it is something that, especially if you're selling to government municipalities and, maybe not for profit, maybe not, yeah, not for profits for sure, because I think their funding is being cut. But if you're selling it to government or organizations, then I think that's something that entrepreneurs should definitely consider. Whether that would increase, you mean the domestic sort of demand? I think that's what people are talking about. I think, I've been to a couple conferences in the last months, and I was surprised that one of them was actually in healthcare, and I was surprised to hear that. To me, every single company that was selling the device, I was like, hey, what are you doing to mitigate the risk? Like, what's going on? How are you thinking about it? I was curious to see what entrepreneurs were sort of doing. And then a lot of the answers I got, I was actually surprised to hear, which were in the lines of, this is we don't really see it as a threat. I think it's great because then, you know, our hospitals will actually could potentially that this could be sort of a turning point in our healthcare system procuring our devices. I think it'd be awesome, and definitely it would be about time. You know, I think there are a lot of great initiatives there to really help sort of change the procurement for a lot of our hospitals here in Canada. And if this is sort of that, you know, incentive or that would help them get over it, then that would be great for Canadians because at the end of the day, we're getting that care, the entrepreneurs and so on and so forth. However, it's still a very it's still a small market, so it's part of your strategy, it's part of your market opportunity, your target market. It's not the whole target market. So I think as an entrepreneur, you still have to think about what comes next. These things take time. I don't think the procurement will change in a matter of weeks. And so even if it actually ends up being materialized, it ends up materializing, it will take time before we get there. So I think it's a little bit naive to think that, in my opinion. I think as an entrepreneur, you got to think about all the risks and where they can come from and how to mitigate them. You know, there's some positive there, but I think we still have to be sort of cautiously optimistic about what's going on in the US and how that would affect the business. And maybe that is not necessarily looking into the US. Maybe it's other opportunities, UK, Australia, some sort of similar countries with similar healthcare systems, or that could be interesting to probe and look into while sort of the US stabilizes. That could be another opportunity. But sort of putting all your eggs in one basket is probably not the best strategy, as we know, if you're an entrepreneur.
Do you think entrepreneurship is innate or can it be learned? And personally for you, do you think you were born an entrepreneur or did you learn it as you grew?
I think it's a bit of both. It's a good question if it's innate or you learn it. I think the appetite for risk is definitely something that probably not necessarily it's something you learn. I think you have some of it, but you can learn as well. I think that there has to be sort of a some sort of curiosity, desire, willingness to take the risk and kind of ability to figure things out, and like kind of going from something and trying to build, trying to go from nothing going from nothing, trying to build something. But I do think there's a lot of other aspects of entrepreneurship that you just have to learn. I don't think that's enough in and of itself to be a good entrepreneur. I think there are some ingredients that can make you sort of be more prone to leaving your comfortable job and starting a company or completely changing careers or whatever. Like entrepreneurship is not always just about starting a company. It can be manifested through different ways, but you also have to really work hard to learn a lot of other aspects that maybe are not necessarily something that are innate. You know, both my parents, when I think when I reflect on this, both my parents are actually were entrepreneurs in their own different ways. And my dad just tried when I was growing up, he was always on new things, working on he had his job, but he was also on the side just doing so many different things. I can't even count them. And my mom as well. So both of them super curious. Both of them definitely has that entrepreneurship. And I'm even looking at my siblings and, you know, I'd say 2 out of 4 kind of went into entrepreneurship. So definitely and definitely some experiences when I, you know, growing up kind of going with my father to all of his different projects that were ongoing, you're like, you know, you're curious about them, you want to help. And so many times I actually spent instead of spending the summer I don't know, surfing, playing on the beach because I grew up in a coastal city. I spent them working for my father, because like I was like curious about what he was building, and I wanted to help and support. And so definitely this sparks curiosity, I think. And there are some parts of it. There are a lot of, I think there are some small things that I definitely learned from him, and from my mom growing up. Probably the grit, the never always keep trying. Things are not going to work out all the time, but that's okay. Just move on to the next one and try again. It's very good. It's probably a good question to reflect on more and more, but that's sort of my perspective.
Talk to me about some examples when you're talking to founders, and what are some red flags you're looking for? There's a recent book by Ilya Strebunov, Venture Mindset, where he states charm is one of the biggest predictors of founder success. And inherently, I want to refute that because I want to say it's the substance that matters, not if you're charming or not. But when I think of successful founders, most of them are charming in their own right. So what are some things you look for, like grit, or have they always been an entrepreneur, or charm? And how do you screen for those things? And if you could give us some examples where, you're like, okay, this is a big red flag, and this is a no because of what's happening right in front of me right now.
It's interesting you're talking about charm, because storytelling, whether you want to consider that part of charm or charm part of storytelling, but kind of definitely something, people will gravitate around entrepreneurs that are really strong storytellers, whether that is for fundraising or for signing that first client. And so I always try to actually, every time I'm like, I want to take a step back and actually think about, because it's easy to get excited, by a story and by an opportunity, and or if you want to call it the charm, and you're like, wow, this is really great. He or she is a strong founder, and I really want to invest. I always try to back check it with facts. I'm always one to be like, oh, I just want to take time to, like, I just want to reflect on this. Like, I try to keep myself in check, actually, not necessarily completely buying into that, not believing, but just always kind of making sure that I'm not totally sort of buying the story and like completely and letting that lead my investment decisions, if you want to put it that way. Red flags. I think there could be a few. I don't think charming or storytelling is a red flag. I think it's a great quality, and I think a lot of us should actually get better at it. we talk a lot about women entrepreneurs, women, getting more investments. I think part of it is maybe the storytelling, because women don't tend to be sort of embellishing stories, and they're sort of more factual. Like, they will tell things as they are, not necessarily as and so I think that is actually detrimental to women founders, and even maybe investors in a lot of ways, or just women in the professional world, if we want to make it more general. On red flags, it's really interesting. I think sort of maybe how much, I think that the team building, again, coming back to it, how much time have you put into that, delegating? It's not necessarily red flags, but you're like, what is this? What is the capacity of the CEO to actually scale? Because you cannot scale a business by doing all of it all alone or with your co-founder. You have to be able to hire. The choice of the hires is always very something that I would look at. So your management team, what do they look like? Who are they? What's their background? Do you actually strive to get surrounded by people that are smarter than you, that are better than you, to elevate you and the company? Or you want to be as a CEO, you want to be the smartest person in the room, and so you're going for folks that not. So I think that is actually a red flag if you're not, if you're not able to, and open to hire people that are smarter than you. Then to me, that's sort of a little bit of a yellow flag. Okay, why? Is it because you actually couldn't find anybody, or is it because you really always want to be the smartest person in the room? So, I think that's the main one to me. If I have to qualify sort of a red flag or a yellow one, but there could be other things. I think, going through the diligence, there it's a collection. It's a collective of thoughts and across different aspects of the business. So it's really hard to, like, at the end of the day, all of these elements should come together to inform that decision. But yeah.
Going a tip for our audience, if you want to ask a founder or anyone about their weaknesses, ask them who their ideal chief of staff or co-founder would be and what qualities would they possess. And usually the people will list their weaknesses because they want someone who completes their weaknesses instead of asking them directly. Let's go deeper into the intuition versus structure framework. How much do you rely on intuition when making an investment decision? Or is it more, and this is more common in PE, where you have a scoring sheet, and if the startup scores over 90, you invest. And then do you have to reach full conviction before you invest? I was speaking with Bharat from Amplitude. And he said something very interesting. From what I remember, he said he only needs 50% conviction. Because if you have full conviction, you're missing something, and it's impossible to have full conviction in early stage investing. Do you agree with that statement? And how much do you rely on intuition versus structure?
Yeah, you can't have 100% full conviction, and it really depends what you mean by conviction. Again, I think it's very relative. And you can say I have 100% full conviction on investing in this company because I am convict, I'm convinced this is scoring 100% against your own sort of framework. That's what you need, I think, on. Like, you need full conviction against your own framework. Like, if you're going into a business and you're like, yeah, I don't know, like, I don't like the fam, like, as you mentioned earlier, I'm not sure this is the right CEO, but I'm still going to do the deal. I think that's, you probably have to pause there and be like, okay, am I actually convinced? Maybe there's not. Now, if you're talking about having 100% conviction, this is going to be a winner, you'll never know. Like, 9 out of 10 companies fail. Like, we're doing early stage investing. So many things can go wrong. We're talking about tariffs. Like the market can go wrong. The product may not work. The team, like, there's so many areas of risks that it's impossible to have a bulletproof, and you cannot say with certainty that this is actually going to be a winning company. And you cannot back it with facts. That's for sure. So there's always, you're going in, you are in a, you're risk taking, in your investment decisions, you're taking a lot of risk and a lot of bets, really. And so you're going into that investment and you're like, well, I have the conviction I need, but obviously a lot of things can go wrong, and those are all the risks, and maybe some others that I'm probably missing. So that's how I would frame it. So I don't know exactly what the context of that conversation was, but I would assume it was alluding to the second sort of case that I talked about. Intuition is definitely important. I think it's more than intuition, it's also a little bit of pattern recognition. In VC investing, it's super early stage. Again, not a lot. A lot of things are still work in progress. And the company you're going to invest in today will probably not be anything like the company that will become 5 years from now. Like, it's, these companies are going to change a lot between the time you invest and the time you exit. Or so, but with that being an, so that's why I do think it's pattern recognition. It is a numbers game in a sense where if you look at enough deals and you do a, you look at, you kind of work with a ton of entrepreneurs, you work on a lot of deals, you start picking on some patterns. Or and so I think that is that pattern recognition kind of feeds into your gut, feeds into that instinct versus sort of the diligence, especially in early stage. There are many things that you can't really fully 100% diligence, because this is, you are investing in the future, which you can't predict. But so there's definitely a combination of both. Now there are things that you can clear. You know, in if you're doing pre-seed and seed, it's probably almost all team and instinct, in a way. And so that's why repeat entrepreneurs will always have an easier time to fundraise, for example, because we tend to believe that someone who succeeded in the past can actually succeed in the future. I don't know how much data backs that. I honestly don't know. I don't know if you do, but in entrepreneurship, I am a big believer that the past does not predict the future. So a lot of the times you kind of hire someone from for the team, for example, in a C-level position, and you're like, this person was in the exact same position in a company that was operating in the same space, and they did a great job. They successfully led a team or whatever, hit all the milestones, succeeded the milestones. You bring them on the team, it doesn't work. I think there's a huge element of culture. You know, the timing, as I said, is different. There are some elements that are not necessarily factored, and can still that I think that can change the outcome. So I don't think, I'm not sure that, you know, I think repeat entrepreneurs will come into it, you know, knowing a little bit more than first-time founders. But you can't claim that they would know it all. So I think if you're doing pre-seed and seed, a lot of instinct, obviously, you just have to buy into the vision. You probably have to be visionary yourself in terms of like, what is that market going to look like? And so kind of try to reconcile that with what the products, what the company is building, and hopefully that's a match. If you're doing sort of more, if you want to name it Series A, Series B, you have a little bit more data. You have some clients. You have some. It's early stage still, and I think there the biggest question is, can it scale, and if it can scale, at what pace? And so that's, and I think that's when it becomes a little bit more, you know, about team, about ability to hire the right people, about ability to take the right decisions in terms of product, to really sort of time it all out, for a successful outcome.
Yeah, the ability to scale is something I find first-time founders often under mark for, and a good distribution strategy is could be your defensibility. The data 10 years ago did not back what you're saying, but now it does. There's a study from Harvard in 2002, I want to say, which is what everyone quotes, which said repeat founders are 40% more likely to succeed. But there have been several studies, mostly out of Europe and Germany, that have countered that evidence. And now, at least the academic world, kind of, from what I understand, says there's no difference in repeat and first-time founders. If you woke up as the Prime Minister of Canada tomorrow, how would you increase early-stage healthcare VC funding in Canada? And this is based on, the report you put out that it's only 5% of VC money in Canada goes to early stage for healthcare versus 30% in the US. At early stage, I'm assuming we're defining by, we can pick a valuation sub 5 million or sub 10 million. How would you change that framework in Canada? And why do you think that discrepancy exists between Canada and US?
I guess on the data point itself, I mean, I wouldn't want to wake up as a prime minister, but on the data point itself, the I think the 5% that we're alluding to, because PitchBook actually look, that's why I think we said young companies, They define early stage as companies that are less than 5 years old.
Okay,
So
so
that is
it's
actually
a,
quite interesting
that's not how
because that
I
means,
would define it. Yeah, but
yes, that's not how, but that's how PitchBook defines it. And I think we alluded to that, but that's how they define it, which we thought actually, I thought quite interesting because that means we are willing, it's like companies that are 5 years old or less, they especially in healthcare, it takes time. And so 5 years is not a lot of time. Like if you're starting a company in healthcare, you're probably barely getting somewhere. So I think it's just, I think it, the risk, the appetite for risk. We don't look at biotech, so biotech is excluded from there. I do think we have a pretty strong ecosystem going on the biotech side, but we have some ecosystem, we have some investors, we have good track record, few exits that were definitely over $1 billion in the last, actually just the last year, I think we had three or four. So there is a little bit of that maturity there. On the digital health and sort of the healthcare IT space and a bit of the sort of med device, non-surgical ones, I think that that is actually very, very new ecosystem in Canada. Like I'm just reflecting on the last 8 years. Like there were not a lot of companies building in that space. So it's very, very immature. And so it will take time to build companies that are successful, that will kind of help build out that ecosystem, and that will support. It's really a chicken and egg problem, because you need companies building, and you need strong ones, and you need, founders, you need investors, and you need that flywheel. There are, I think the early stage investing, generally speaking, is definitely underserved in Canada. And I think that is probably a little bit of the culture there, appetite for risk, maybe the profile of the investors in funds that require a certain return. And so that really trickles down because at the end of the day, everyone is sort of trying to, if there is sort of if there is reticence to take risk from like sort of the LP base, then there is reticence to like to take risk from the GP base then. So it does trickle down. But I think we've seen it mature in a big way in the last few years. And mind you, in Canada, we do have a lot of a lot of grants. We have SR&ED. So every dollar kind of lasts a bit longer, but at the same time, companies don't tend to raise as much as their counterparts. So, and these grants and all that are kind of comes with strings attached and reporting and so, and tweaking things in a certain way. So whether that can be actually revised and reviewed to be more optimized, and not, I don't know, all this money that goes into grants, can we actually structure it as more forgivable loans or equity or something in between? And so, if the company doesn't go anywhere, you would have attributed it as a grant anyways. But if there's an upside, then you are part of the upside, and you can actually, and that maybe will. I always thought this is something that I always reflect on, and I'm always like, why grants versus some other instrument that government can actually be part of the upside, and then on the downside, it would have been written off in any case because it was all grant money. So, but I don't have the answer to that. I'm not privy to, but it's something that I'd be curious to hear more about and learn more about on a personal level. But yeah, I think that sort of COVID definitely, I think it's definitely a tough times, tougher times. I think we had COVID, we had the highs in 2021, and obviously we're hitting a little bit of a low right now in terms, and the US is similar. Like when you look at the data, the contraction in the US is, I think, the same or kind of 20% less or something as in Canada. The difference is their ecosystem is huge, so 20% less is obviously notable, but not completely it's not going to destroy the ecosystem. Whereas our ecosystem is so small, so 20% not no only notable, you're like, this is like have a huge impact on the ecosystem, has a huge impact on the activity within that one. So we'll have to, you know, I do think the hardest job is to build a company, and we just, you know, I think my question is, you know, and the one that actually like that I think about the most and I talk a lot about as well is the pipeline of entrepreneurs. How many comp like the opportunity cost today went is high compared to a few years ago. Like a few years ago, you can do, you know, kind of you can have a job, you can still build something in between. It wasn't super expensive to, you know, the cost of living was not as expensive as it is today. So today, a lot of, unfortunately, we don't see as many people taking the route of entrepreneurship for all kind of reasons. And I do worry about the future if we don't have enough folks building out there and starting new companies.
If you had to build a startup today, what startup would you build? And maybe through the lens of what healthcare startups and what vertical, building what product, would have the easiest time raising funds?
I think AI is definitely, I don't think we touched so much on that, but it's definitely one that is a good, I think that's a good keyword or to fundraise off of. Like we've seen so many companies raise on the thesis that they're building something with it. I think this whole agentic AI is quite interesting, like not having necessarily. I was in Nashville at Vive last week, and I was really impressed by all the work that's being done there. And some of it was quite bold, like in a sense where you'll have an AI mental health therapist, and you it's not going to be a human in the loop. It's not going to be tech enabled. It's going to be the AI, and so. And it was quite real. Like you see these demos, you're like, wow, like this is quite interesting. Then you read about all these youth that have AI friends or have AI boyfriends or girlfriends, and you're like, wow, like I thought that was actually mind-blowing,
I don't
and
know if that's a
I
good
am
thing, though.
super curious. No, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I thought it was because I think it was it like a study, like 18% of youth has like AI friends or something date some AI, like all
Yeah,
the.
but there's been a few studies. People prefer AI chatbots for mental health counseling as opposed to human counselors because they find them more empathetic. And they don't
It's,
perceive them as
yeah.
biases, and they don't judge because they're not human, so they cannot judge. Whereas they worry humans will judge them if they kind of, say I lied or I cheated or I did this. The worry
Yeah.
is, yeah, and AI doesn't. But I don't know. I'm not. I don't know if that's. I think too much technology. It's funny because what's best for mental health is to move away from technology, right? And sleep better,
Yeah.
exercise more, spend more time
Yes.
outside with family, cook our food, grow our food, not, tell our worries to Headspace or Calm. But yeah, sorry, I interrupted you there.
No. It's actually a good point. It's just it's mind-blowing to me that there's this level of acceptability to such technologies. So I think, you know, agentic AI, I think anything that's Scribe and all that probably in my opinion has been done and won in a way. I think you can still see some opportunities in very specialized Scribe stuff, but I think anything that's sort of all the Gen AI, the agentic AI is definitely opening up a whole lot of doors for all kind of things and all type of industries. So yeah, that's what I would and today we were talking about cost of, you know, opportunity of the cost of opportunity went up for entrepreneurs, and hopefully it's kind of the cost of building a company has is coming down with sort of what we've seen with DeepSeek and all that, and so now you know, maybe with these two elements in mind, you can sort of see a re maybe an influx in folks taking the initiative and going out and building companies, because now they can build them for less cheap, for much cheaper, and don't necessarily have to raise a lot of money to get to the same milestone.
Yeah, that's well said. Thanks so much for joining us today, Miriam. And we'll have to do a part two soon.
Yeah, thank you, Rashad. Appreciate it.